Hi, welcome to another episode of Django Chat, a podcast on the Django Web Framework. I'm Carlton Gibson, joined as ever by Will Vincent. Hello, Will.
Hi, Carlton.
Hello, Will. And today we've got with us Adam Hill, who's a longtime developer and author of Django Unicorn and lots of other exciting packages that I'm hoping to talk about today. Hello, Adam. Thank you for coming on the show.
Hello. I've been listening for a long time, so normally it's at like 2 times the speed, so this is a little bit different, but I'm excited to talk to you guys. I really appreciate you.
We'll be slightly lower pitched, yeah.
That's right. That's right.
That's good. So we always ask, Adam, I don't want to jump straight into Django Unicorn. You've got lots of other things. So we always ask about the backstory, and you've been around for a long, long time. So perhaps you could tell us how you got into programming, how you found Django. You know, what's your origin story?
Hi. So, I've been programming for over 20 years. So I've been around for a while. And in my day job at the Molly Fool, we use C# and a lot of the Microsoft stack.
Before you carry on that, I want to ask you, so I'm always fascinated by the Microsoft stack and the C# stack. Like, when you're working on Django, what are the sort of bits that you miss? What are the really nice bits of working in that ecosystem?
In the Microsoft stack?
So,
I started working in Django because I wanted to get away from the Microsoft stack. But the nice thing about it, I guess, is that it's sort of all integrated with each other. If you're on Windows, you use SQL Server, you use, just the whole stack together, whereas Django, you kind of have a little more flexibility, and with that comes a little more choice. So you have to choose Postgres or MySQL, and you have to choose Unicorn or, you know, what your serving platform is. So it becomes there's just more choices there.
Okay. But there's not one bit that when you eat, like even today, you're coding with Django and you think, oh, do you know that bit from .NET, that I wish I had that, or I wish I had.
I don't personally. I'm sure some people do.
No, that's a fair answer. I'll accept it. Okay, so anyway, you're at Motley Fool, programming C#, you think?
Yeah, so I'm looking around. It's like 2010, and all the fancy startups are using Ruby on Rails, and they're kind of outside of this ecosystem. But my friend introduces me to someone who wants to start a startup, which is for house auctions. So it's the idea is about as dumb as it sounds. It's like we're going to start a house auction at $1 and let people bid, and then they get a house at the end. So I was
just
like,
ahead of your time. Ahead of your time, I think, right? That's an open door and stuff too, sort of.
I was like, well, this might not work out, but it'll be a fun excuse to try something different outside of the whole Microsoft ecosystem. And so I was reading about Rails, and I was reading about other frameworks, and I came across this Django thing. And it was mostly, I think, the ORM, and at the time it was South, which you could do migrations. And I was like, mind blown. Like, I don't have to manually write stored procedures. Sign me up. So I tried working with this startup for a while, and I used Django at the time. I think it was 1.2. And I really loved Django, and I found all these things that I really loved about it. And I found out that the startup was not going to work out for all sorts of reasons, but that was fine. And so that was my first introduction to Django. And then around 2011, our CTO at the time kind of looked at a couple of us techies and said, if there was any tech stack that you would use, what would we use if we were starting from scratch? And so I advocated for Django at the time. Some other people advocated for Rails and some other things.
How did you decide that? Pistols at Dawn?
Yeah, that was basically it. So it was I don't remember. It was so long ago. It was
no
mostly
problem.
A conversation. It was like, let's try this and let's try that. And I just convinced a lot of people that we should try it out. But
is the long and short of that the Motley Fool is built on Django these days? Or
yeah, so most of the user facing site is in Django. We have some backend services that are still in C# because you don't want to have to rewrite everything, and they still work, and it's perfect. And we have some WordPress sites as well. So it's a couple of different technologies, but most of what you see when you hit the site is all served from Django.
Okay, super.
Can I ask about Python? Had you used Python before Django, or because that's also a big part of the Django experience as opposed to the Microsoft stack?
You know, I haven't, or I didn't. I think when I looked at when I was evaluating other frameworks, Python was a big point in there. It was like, oh, I really like the way that this looks. It was aesthetic, and sort of the ecosystem around Django and Python. Even at that time, it was still like, oh, there's all these packages that I can use and pull in, and I don't have to rewrite all this stuff. That was really appealing to me.
Yeah, I think because for me, I think it was around 2010-ish when I got into programming, and I was in San Francisco, and it was Rails, Django, and really I waited it. Rails was way more popular, but I thought Python looked better to me than Ruby, and also even then had more applications. And so, yeah, I'm always interested to hear what, but, because a lot of people, they come into their first framework with no knowledge of web frameworks, and so they kind of blame the framework for the learning curve of that. But if you already kind of know how websites work, you skip that blame, right? It's only kind of like your second or third. You're like, oh, maybe it wasn't Rails or Django that was so hard. It's just the web is a little bit trickier than I gave it credit for.
Yeah, it turns out these things are just hard in general. So,
yeah, that's why I tell, like, I generally don't deal with technical people in my personal life. And sometimes they're like, well, yeah, there's like hundreds or thousands of employees at these companies. I'm like, yeah, well, if it was easy, because they're like, Will, you can build Instagram in a weekend. I'm like, yeah, for like 10 people, but like, a billion, there's a reason. It gets a lot harder.
It's always the scaling that becomes tricky.
Right. Yeah. It's like one or two front end, a couple Django, and then DevOps infrastructure.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
Anyway, sorry, Carlton, you had a thread of questioning.
No, Adam, I want to speak to you about your open source packages, sort of the main one. Now, which way around do you want to take it? Do you want to do Unicorn first or last?
Sure. Yeah, that sounds good.
First or last? Do you want to do Unicorn first or last?
First is fine.
Okay, let's talk about Django Unicorn then. For people who don't know it, can you tell us what it is, and then we can discuss various aspects around it?
Sure. So this short pitch is basically it's a reactive component framework on top of Django. So it basically lets you have a Python class and a template, and they kind of are tied together. They're bound, and you can render that Python template inside of a regular, Django template. And then you can have attributes on the HTML. So you could like click a button and it will call something in the Python class and then re-render on the front end and things have changed. So it's that's the easiest way to explain it.
And when you say reload on the right, it just reloads that bit of the page, right?
It's just that little portion of your template. And you can actually target, even if you wanted smaller pieces, to like reduce the payload. But basically, when I was looking around at things, I don't know if you've seen like Elixir's live view.
Yes.
So basically they use WebSockets in the back end and they do this sort of reactive functionality. And I looked at it and I was like, you don't have to write any JavaScript to have interactivity on your website. That's like crazy, right? And I kind of wanted that for Django. So I actually built a prototype using Django channels, which Carlton, I know you work on. And I found it more cumbersome than I wanted it to be. So I didn't want to run Redis. I didn't want to run a separate process. And so I was looking around a little bit more. And in PHP's Laravel, they have Livewire. And instead of WebSockets, to make that interactivity, they use regular old AJAX requests. So it sounds a little, when you first think about it, you're like, you're going to make an AJAX request for every update, and then you're going to pass back HTML from the server side. Some people are like, that doesn't make a lot of sense. Like, it's not going to be performance, and, you know, why would you do it when you can just use these WebSockets? But the upside is that it makes deployment really simple, because you're just, it's just Ajax. It's already what the server is dealing with. And if you look at sort of GitHub, or there's other examples, but GitHub is the canonical one. If you watch the network inspector, they're passing back snippets of HTML. It's not JSON, you know, with some SPA on top that's re-rendering it. So it's a pattern that lots of big sites use. And Unicorn basically, it gives you an easy way to do that without wiring up all the bits by yourself. Because I know in Django right now, HTMX is really hot and people love it. And I love it too. I've used it on some of my side projects. It's really great. And Carson is, you know, an awesome developer and a great advocate for this style of web programming, I guess. But you still have to create your URLs, create new routes. You have to make sure your templates are set up in a certain way. And so the one thing that Unicorn does is it kind of handles it all. I call it its magic, but, you know, it gives you a pattern for doing that sort of thing.
Right. So that was the question I was going to ask. So this HTML over the wire thing. So the Rails, they use the hot wire, right? Which
yep,
is their version. And then HTMX has blown up. It's very big. And I was going to ask you, so you're in exactly the same place, the same strategy. What, you know, can you just go over again? What is the selling point of Django Unicorn versus HTMX? For all the folks that have seen HTMX explode and big on that, what do I get extra when I come and check out Django Unicorn? What would be the selling there?
Yeah, so the selling point is that it sort of gives you this little pattern that you can add interactivity easily to your site without having to wire up all the manual bits. It also integrates, it's basically Django aware, right? It tries to play nicely in the ecosystem. You can use Django messages inside of your Python class, and things just work sort of as you expect. Validation works the same way. You can use forms. It knows about Django, and so it can be a little bit smarter about what it's doing. There's support for Django models and query sets. You know, I try to just sort of integrate it into the whole, you know, ecosystem, so it feels like it's part of a Django project, as opposed to something that you kind of add on and then have to fiddle with.
I want to mention that you have, I think, 2 screencasts now with plans for more, where you go over like a basic. Those are great, like, because it's exactly that question, right? I'm sure I saw, like, I've researching this episode on Reddit and other places. Everyone asks you, well, why not HTMX? And, you know, I feel like the 2 you have certainly show it, and then the plans for more. Kind of eager. I hope you get a chance to do those as well.
Yeah, it turns out screencasts take way more time than I ever
That's why I don't do them. They're so.
It's not just sit down and bang away.
So yeah, I mean, it's just like a conference talk. Honestly, it's 3 minutes as opposed to, you know, 45 or whatever. But between trying to write out a script and make code that makes sense that I can show, and then finding a quiet space in my house that I can record it, it's like, I'd rather write some code and just like put some new features out there as opposed to making a screencast. So, you know, that's my own fault.
Well, I think that's every developer, right? It's like you build this thing, and then the demands are like 9 out of 10, the selling of it rather than the doing of it. So.
Yeah, I mean, I have a blog post in my head about sort of like open source and how, you know, just writing the code and getting something out there is like just, it's the first step. You're at like step zero, basically, at that point. And then a lot of the, you know, the where Unicorn sort of like caught on a little bit was more on the marketing side. So like I built a whole site that has little, you know, small demos that people can play with and see. And, you know, I went on Reddit and I tried to advertise it a little bit. And so, you know, there's a, there's that whole other part of writing code when you're in the open source ecosystem that like people don't really think about or maybe don't want to work on because it's the less fun part.
And I know you're building the bookmarking site, devmarks.io. Is that built with Unicorn?
Yeah, it uses Unicorn. Basically, I have side projects so that I can dog food my own side projects. So it's sort of like turtles all the way down.
the hairiest yak in the world, one way or the other.
So DevMarks uses Unicorn and a bunch of my other libraries. And basically, I just wanted to make something to store all my GitHub stars. I mean, that's basically what the genesis of that project was. Because, you know, I wanted to have a better interface that I could see all those stars and I could sort of attach notes to them. Now they have lists in GitHub, which is kind of nice. You can organize. But yeah, I wanted some place where you grab all that stuff. And I was like, well, if I'm getting GitHub stars, there's probably other things that I could also pull in and bookmark for later. So there's like Hacker News favorites and there's all sorts of other sites that I sort of integrate with, but that was the plan.
So it's devmarks.io is the URL there, and that's free to sign up for. And
yeah.
Do you have plans to? Mm-hmm. Go on, Cameron. Go ahead, Cameron.
Oh, no. Yeah, it's free. You can sign in with GitHub. There's plans to monetize it. If you want to pay me $5 a month, feel free. You can. But for most people, they just use the free side, and that's fine too. It's most of my things are to scratch my own itch. So I don't think I'm ever going to make a whole lot of money off of these things. I have a day job, and that's fine. Yeah, that's how I survive. So it's all good.
What I was going to ask is, do you have any thoughts on the? I bookmark a lot of sites. You know, I've got a key command. I see that, but it's kind of like an append only list in that. Mm-hmm. They go onto the list and mm-hmm. it might be like 5-10 links a day and it saves me having to read them there and then, but the reality is I very rarely go back and sort of process that list. So I think that's normal. I've spoken to a lot of people that have the same phenomenon. Have you got any thoughts in how we might use something to, you know, surface this?
Well, Carlton, I just want to add that Jeff Triplett, who I do the Django newsletter with, was jokingly saying maybe I should just publish like all my tabs I did or didn't read on Twitter. Good. And I think a bunch of people are like, yeah, I'd like that.
Yeah, tabs I've got open at this date.
Yeah,
I don't. I have no help for you because I have the same problem. But if you figure out something, I would love to hear about it.
Okay, fine.
I don't know.
I'm hoping somebody's going to come up with something that will just say, "Oh, you know, you've bookmarked a site on this of 3 years ago."
Well, Carlton, you're so like, you know, monastic in some ways, reading Kant at night. You just got to let it go, and you're never going to read them. Like I don't
I start
the day, and it's just empty because I don't even pretend. I don't want that burden of like I should do this.
Right, but this is why I use it. So I used to have this problem where I'd have like 4,000 tabs open and I could never find any, and I'd just keep them open at all. And so what I decided was that if I just bookmark every single site that I see, every site that I would leave open in a tab, I bookmark it and close the tab. And it's amazing because now I have like 1-2 tabs and, you know, if it's really hectic end of the day, there might be 10 tabs, but I never have 50. And it's like a closed loop. Because if you've got an open tab, it's constantly sort of in your decision cycle going, do I need to read this now? Do I need to read this now?
It's an endless loop. Yeah. But like recursive loop or something, I use a search history. So like, very often I'm like, oh yeah, what was that thing? I wish I hadn't closed it. And then I just go into my search history and there it is.
Okay, so we'll do a listener shout out to ideas if you send in postcards
usual PO box. It's a tension though. It's a tension between endlessly curious, which I think many good developers are, and then not getting bogged down with trying to learn everything, right? I think especially for people, I get this email pretty often from readers who like, I just don't even know where to go. Like there's so many things to read, and I think with time you're kind of like, well, if I needed to turn over that stone, I could, but there's sort of a context. You don't need to like master everything and, like React stuff. It's like, yeah, it's going to change every couple of months. Like, but And you can kind of let go of that anxiety around not knowing anything, I think. But the first couple of years, you feel like you have to keep up with that. Whereas, I mean, there, you know, so many things I don't know. I don't know, go around telling everyone it, but like, I don't pretend otherwise. It's just like, well, if I needed to, like, so I don't, for me, that's a coping mechanism.
I think after the first couple of years, you basically know enough to start, and that's good enough. And then you can figure out as you're going along and build on that knowledge. But that first couple of years, that's the tricky part, is like, where do I even start here? Like, there's so much.
Yeah. Well, does this come out? Yeah, this will come out. So DjangoCon US is coming up. Carlton just got back from DjangoCon Europe. And my talk is a 45-minute talk on aligning the Django puzzle pieces, where I'm going to try to present the tapestry of Django as a whole, as a roadmap for people. Because I feel like many people learn it, you know, it's like puzzle pieces, but they're all flipped upside down. You have no idea where you're going, and somehow they fit together. So to at least say, here's the map of Django, and it will take a long time to cover it, but here's kind of the context I wish I had those first couple of years.
So those are all the pieces of Django to like build a,
well, both,
a Django
both of,
site?
Both of how websites work, and then the Django parts. So, you know, models, URLs, templates, views, admin, but also like what are signals, middleware, like ORM, query sets, you know. So dig deeper into things, the geo stuff, just give a sense of here is like the entirety of Django. And, you know, so here's the fundamentals, and then here's all this cool goodies. Deployment, like deployment is such a big topic. But, and Carlton, actually, I was thinking of you because you still like multiple settings files, right, for your deployments, as opposed to one setting file and environment variables?
Am I allowed to even admit that these days? Is that not something you're allowed to admit anymore? No, I do like, I still like multiple settings files because, do you know what? I see people jumping through a lot of hoops trying to fit everything into the environment variables only pattern. And I think it's time for the pendulum to start swinging back another way, where it's like, do you know what? If you're fighting with your environment settings or environment variables, trying to put everything into an environment variable so that you can just, you know, change your M file or change your folder in order to change your deployment settings, maybe you want to just, you know, stick that in a separate settings file where it's easy to read and you don't have this massive amount of machinery that's needed to be put in place, enable you to switch environment. Maybe it's time for the pendulum to switch back another way. And then, of course, we'll end up with multiple settings files and everybody hard coding secrets in the wrong places and everything that, and we'll swing back to environment variables or, you know, something, because apparently we're not allowed to use environment variables anymore because they can be, I don't know what.
Adam, what do you think of all this?
Yeah, I was going to say, I tend to do both of those things. So maybe I'm like a little bit of one. Yeah, I have multiple settings files for each environment. And then for anything that's secret, I use a M file to pull the things in. So that might be even more, you know, messier than both those approaches. But
the one thing I do agree is you shouldn't put your secrets in the file itself, but you know, sometimes there's various bits and bobs that you need to customize per environment. It's much more suited to have a separate settings file for than trying to push all of that into environment variables. Yeah, you don't want to hard code secrets in the file itself. Yes, that's when the community decided to emphasize not doing that. That was a good step forward that everyone should follow. But you know, like all these things, we end up sort of gravy chaining is not the right word.
Now I sound like an old man, but the, you know, GitHub back in the day when it first came out, you could search for AWS secret keys, like you could, you know, you could find everything. And now I'm sure GitLab is the same, you know, they they don't let you just search for that stuff, but you could just, you know, get anything. So I think there's a little more guardrails, but
I think these days they might even send you, like they might sort of walk up behind you quietly and do a little cough and get your attention
security.
And tell you that
But I think pedagogically, to teach to someone new, saying one file and then you have your local environment variables and your production environment variables, don't worry about staging, don't worry about all this other stuff, is a little bit simpler than a custom command to load different settings files. Plus, all the platforms as a service require environment variables anyways. So if you're using, well, what used to be Heroku, I agree. It's not a canonical thing.
I mean, my
go on, I'm just going to say, go on,
My pitch for Django is that, you know, that there is a canonical way to solve for this. I think that would be nice, and it would kind of get around some of this conundrum of what you're supposed to do.
With what specifically? There is a, like, Django is a canonical way to do these things?
No. Like, inside of Django, when you create new project, then it basically sets up your files the way, so you have multiple settings files, or, you know, it creates a M file, and and it kind of just, like, it lets you down, you know, into the pit of success. And so people just know that, like, this is the way to do this thing. Cause it is a thing that pops up all the time. It's the same with, you know, should I deploy my React app with my, DRF app? You know, that I see the same sort of questions on Reddit over and over and over again of, like, how do I do this thing? And, I think the more that Django can provide, it doesn't have to be super opinionated, but if it can provide some guidance in, like, and this is how you want to do this thing that 80% of the people want to do, I think that would be beneficial.
Okay, so I don't normally say things that are on the forward agenda, because it just ends up people going, well, why isn't that ready yet? But this summer I was very much focusing on async tickets. I've got one more pair of things to try and get into 4.2 for on the async front, and then we want to swing around to a proposal to modernize the request object, and maybe add JSON parsing to the request object. So you just go request.data, and if it's a JSON request, you'll get JSON data, whereas if it was a form encoded request, you'd get like the equivalent of post data now, like the dot post. So you get form encoded data, but either way, you're going to get that back as a nice dictionary. After that, there is a proposal to actually get round to, okay, what can we look at in terms of making a better story here for people? It's difficult because every time it comes up, there's massive differences in opinions, including to the extent that, no, actually environment variables aren't the way to go, because what you want is a file that you put in place that's read at process launch and then deleted, and then it's sold in a single thing, so it's not, when the process gets dumped, it's not all leaked in the environment. You know, it's the trouble is, you know, there's so many opinions and so many different ways, but we're going to sit down, okay, can we make the template, that start project template, one step up. And it's not an instant process, and, you know, it takes a while to go through, but there are proposals in place, and it's coming to the point where that's bubbling to the top of the backlog to process. So we'll see.
Anyway, that's the one thing I want to talk to people about at DjangoCon US, like in the hallway. I should go research a little bit the past efforts more, but I think that's a big thing. I have thoughts.
As long as you write up those opinions, that's fine.
Yeah, okay.
It needs to be scientific. I need numbers and bar charts. Just a histogram will do. Make it up. So, Adam, Django Unicorn, very good. I know Andy Ide, who builds Horse Redders, I can't stop him talking about it. We're hoping to get him on the show soon. He just absolutely raves about it. So, I think, you know, people should go and check that out. I want to talk about some of your other projects. So, can I talk about the one that I'm really excited about, which is Minestrone, which is a... which is a way of selecting DOM elements from elements from the DOM, right? It's a HTML sort of search library. Tell us about that, because I'll tell you why I want to use it. It's for simplifying HTML test cases where you're testing against rendered HTML. But
yeah, so I think, you know, if you've been in Python for a while, you've used Beautiful Soup if you want to parse HTML, because it's basically the best thing that you can use. It's very lenient and lets you sort of find things in there. There are a couple other libraries that are floating around, but it seems like everyone sort of uses Beautiful Soup. And I use it in all my projects, or a lot of my projects. And I love it. So there's that. I find personally the documentation is a little hard to read. It's just one big long, list of methods. And so every time I'm like, wait, how do I find just this element? And so I have to kind of read through stuff. And the API is sort of, there's a lot. If you look at all of the, attributes and all the classes that are available. So my basic idea was, well, I'm just going to make a little wrapper library. It uses Beautiful Soup underneath the hood because there's nothing better. But maybe I can provide just a nicer API for people to do sort of, I'm always looking for solve the 80% because like the last 20%, that's the hard stuff. And I'm maybe not smart enough to figure that stuff out, but like the 80% I can definitely get. So I have nice methods to basically get elements, loop over all of them, look at your attributes, get the classes. And I tried to do, you know, I tried to make the API as nice as I possibly could. That was another thing that I was really trying to sort of get out of this exercise. And this is just like Unicorn, where it's like, you know, I'm just looking around and I'm like, I feel like this could be better. Like, it doesn't have to be this hard. Like, maybe I can make something and provide it and, you know, make things a little bit easier for people to use the documentation and use the API. So that was the basic thought about it.
Okay. And, and like you said, the basic API is just...
It is load in the HTML and you have a class, and then you can loop over that, get all the elements. You can grab classes from those elements. You can search using... It's basically looks like CSS selectors.
Yeah, so that was the point. Across all the HTML. That was the point I wanted to get, is that you just use a CSS selector, which totally happy with, rather than exit, what's the XPath?
I skipped all that stuff. I don't want that.
So, like, in my entire career, I've never had success with XPath expressions. I just couldn't, they just wouldn't go into my brain in the right way. So, just every time I needed to construct one, I had to go and look up the the query path syntax. Whereas CSS selectors, because you're using them all day, every day, you know them and you can, you know.
Yeah, seemed like an easier approach for people to sort of find things was the CSS selectors.
And so my great sort of what I want from this, I'm not really writing a scraper and extracting links to, you know, crawl the web or any of that stuff, because, you know, if I wanted that, there's frameworks that do scraping for you. But what I want is when you've got HTML, you want to assert equal on the contents, right? You rendered a template. You want to make sure that the template, you know, you're writing a template tag. Is it functioning how you want it to? So you want to get the HTML, and you want to pull it out of a bigger page. You know, what did the page render with the HTML I expected? So if you can query that down to a small HTML element and just match against that, rather than is this string appearing anywhere in this HTML, and it didn't appear, and then it prints the entire page of HTML out, and it's like no. Whereas if you've extracted the one element, you can just have the HTML that for that element appear, and it's like, oh well, I see, I missed an attribute or something.
Yeah, that's a perfect use case for this. You can use Beautiful Soup if you want
to. Yes.
But this might be a little bit easier. So
Yeah. So that's why I'm excited about Minestrone. It's worth checking out. What other projects are you
packing? Yeah, I wanted to ask about Coltrane. I mean, you have so many. But I mean, this is like sort of like a static site via Django, which...
Yeah. Yeah, so Coltrane was Will, the author of Rich and Textual.
Oh, it was like McGune or... Yeah,
I didn't want to... you know, ruin his last name. So
I don't know how to say it. So I'll do. I did it. I don't know. That's just based. But yeah.
He made a tweet a while ago, and it was, you know, like, what static site generator should I use? And it sort of made me start thinking, because all the answers are great. You know, like it's Pelican or Lector, or there's all these Python ones, right? And there's Hugo and there's Jekyll and there's so many. But it sort of just like triggered a thought for me of Django does 90% of what all these other things have rebuilt and done. And maybe Django could do something like these other projects. And so it was just a prototype, and I was like, I wonder if I can do this. So I started by just, I use, actually, Carlton, I think you had a talk at DjangoCon US at some point with a single file. And then Will, I think you have the repo. So this encompasses both of you, which is fun.
Oh, I thought you were going to talk about Carlton stuffing like Pelican into Django, but yeah.
Oh, no.
That was Sphinx. That's Sphinx.
Excuse me.
So, I know, carry on. You use a single file template, right?
Yeah, so I can use this little single file thing and I can make, I can reduce the complexity, right, of what you need when you have a Django project. And so I use both those ideas in this. And basically, it's a Django app and it looks in a particular folder for Markdown files. Everything it sees in there, it renders them to HTML and then outputs them to a different folder, sort of just like every other static site generator. The other fun thing that I did was there's no databases, right, in Django in a static site. So I think it's Hugo and in Lector, there's a couple of options for this, but basically it uses JSON. So you could have sort of a database where you have data inside of JSON and you can pull that out and then shove it into a Django template and it will get rendered as part of your static site generation.
And that JSON lives alongside the Markdown file, is that right?
Yeah, it's in a separate folder, but basically you can basically reach out and interact with it sort of like it was the database is the way that it's set up.
Okay.
And the other thing that I did was I used Adam Johnson's, there's like a browser reload library that he has. So when you're working and you're like, typing up Markdown and stuff, it'll automatically reload the contents. So that's a nice little dev experience. And basically I took Django and I tried to make it as simple as possible for an end user to start up a project. And now it doesn't do everything, right? It's just static content. But it's again that 80-20 rule of just like, if you just need a blog system, like this is a pretty simple way to just start that up. But it still provides all the power of Django behind the scenes. So you can use Django libraries. You have Django templates. So you have template tags that you can do things in. Most of the other Python static site generators use Jinja. So like, it's just a different, it's a different approach, right? But it was really fun to work on. And so I really like it.
Yeah, that's good. So I think that point about being simple. So it's literally just a folder of Markdown is the important thing, right? Because if you can start there. Then if you need a full Django site, there are things, but you still need it static, you could use, there's a Django bakery project, right? Which takes, mm-hmm. So what that does is it sort of reads your URL conf and then crawls the URL conf for every, to enumerate the URLs and then writes a static site. And then I think there's a Wagtail bakery project if you've got a Wagtail site, but that's like a lot more machinery on top. But then you're still able to just host the output of a folder of static HTML files rather than, I've got to spin up a Django process and have that running all the time and everything that's entailed on that.
Yeah, so I have a site called alljango.com. And so it's all a static site. So I use render.com because Heroku is going away, sadly. But Render will host your static sites for free. So I push a change of Markdown to GitHub. Render will pick that up. It runs it's basically a Django management command in the background and then outputs the static HTML and then it's on the site. So it's a nice flow.
That's a cool trade. So go on. I was going to say alljango.com. So I thought that was your homepage. That's like your sort of personal, that's, we're all.
Just another thing that I have out there. That's all.
I feel like our question this fall needs to be like, what platform hosting service do you like and why? Because there's quite a few, and I've been deep diving on this. It sounds like, is Render the one that currently you like, Adam?
That's what I've been using the most. When I looked at Fly, it looked like it was a little harder to start with. I might be wrong about that. But Render, the documentation for Render, was really nice for Django, and it was an easy transition from Heroku. Heroku was my standard forever. And so when I was looking around, it seemed like Render was really the replacement for that. But
so Fly will be changing. I'm contracted with them to write the Django
nice.
Docs. So supposed to do that this week, actually. Because they don't have a dedicated Django docs, and so I've been talking to them, and they're going to have something, both an existing site and a migrating from Heroku. But Render has great stuff too. I'm not making a judgment on platforms, but that is a hole Fly has, and it will be filled shortly.
It's interesting when you look at some of the other ecosystems like Laravel. I think they have their own hosting platform.
That's how they make most of their money. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, I know they have a different sort of philosophy in that framework than Django does. But it is, I look at that ecosystem a lot to be like, and this is a different way to approach the same problem. And maybe there are some learnings there. Maybe it doesn't really work out because, just different approaches by different, communities, which is totally fine. And I love Django. I'm not going to move away from it. So, but
I agree. I think I have a friend who's a Laravel developer, and he's constantly telling me about all the things they're doing. And, sitting on the Django Software Foundation board, I will admit sometimes I look longingly at what they do because it's just, I think it's Taylor is his name, who's like, he can just do stuff. and they make basically all their they make millions of dollars a year on hosting, and then also they have a starter project that like an official starter project, and then from that he's able to do all this, give away all the stuff and do new things. So it is appealing, that it's one less layer of complexity. On the other hand, it's completely dependent on one person. But like, it would be great if Django Start Project gave you a site, kind of like there's starter projects, like I have Django X, there's a whole bunch of them. If there was also an option for like a deployable project, and then click a button, it was up to the vendors, but you could deploy on Render, Fly, take your pick. Friendlier.
I think the project that, I hear what you're saying about Laravel, and there's two things. One there, I think, is that it is one person's project rather than a community-owned project. I think there's something very, very important that Django has the kind of structure, the community-owned project, the community project that it is. And I would defend that against the kind of costs that I think if we were to make it into an entity that had a proper revenue stream of its own, then there would be a real danger that the revenue stream gets hijacked. So, the example, we're not saying this is necessarily right, but in the Apple world, which, part of them follow, all the really long-standing people there are decrying the fact that its revenue stream is now services because it's taking away everything that made Apple the company that they loved over the last 30 years. And I feel the same thing would happen to Django, or an analogous thing would happen to Django if Django became a money-making enterprise. So I'll just put that as a sort of something that we can discuss at a DjangoCon sometime over a few bevies. But Eric Mathers' Django Simple Deploy project, it looks like it's just hitting the absolute button here on, being able to just go automate all deploy, pick your platform. And okay, he started with Heroku and is now like, right, I've got to get the other platforms on, but I think he's got platform.shell going. They were sponsors at DjangoCon
Europe. He's got Fly in almost.
He's got Fly in.
And he's going to plans to add, I've talked to him quite a bit about this. So
to
yes.
add subsequent platforms, right? Mm-hmm. And
that's his goal.
And what looks as well is that it would be very relatively easy for other platform vendors, once they realize that this is the way, to instead of relying on Eric to build the integration, that they could build it themselves and be like, and submit it as a pull request or as a plugin. And so it may be there with the work we were talking previously about improving the Start project, that even though we get there a bit slower, we might be able to get there, anyway, without needing to sell the project into a, like convert or sell the project, but converting the project into a commercial enterprise. So, you know, I hear everybody saying, I just think maybe it's not as bad as all that.
Oh, well, come on. I have so much internal experience. I can just, you know, grass is greener a little bit, but I wouldn't trade places at all.
Yep, agreed.
So let's you've got one more project that, well, maybe you've got other projects, but we'll come back and ask you any other projects. But there's one more project I want to talk about, because it's kind of, you know, you've got your Django function, or FBV, for function-based views.
Yes, so, yes, that's very interesting.
Tell us about that, because obviously function-based views and class-based views, the eternal, you know, potato versus potato of Django.
Yeah, sure. So Django FBV, so at work, I was making a presentation with my coworker about class-based views and function-based views. And, you know, for a long time, I was just like, CBV is too complicated. I don't want to deal with it. I don't want to understand the inheritance hierarchy and everything. But I did this presentation, and so I had to sort of dig into it more than I normally can just avoid. And there are some nice things about CBVs. But I kind of wanted to make a library that provided some of the niceties of class-based views, but still stay in the function-based view world, because to me, it's more simple to understand a request comes in here and there's a response out here, and I don't have to look into any mix-ins and figure out, you know, what is happening inside of here with a class-based view. So for the longest time, there's a library called Django Annoying, which is not the best library name, but I would use it all the time, and it has a bunch of decorators and other, you know, model fields and stuff. But two of the decorators that I would use, there's a, I think it was render two, and then there was an Ajax one. And it basically is just a decorator that you put on top of a function-based view, and you can return a dictionary from it instead of render to response or, you know, HTTP response or whatever. And it will take that dictionary, throw it into context. And you specify the template name inside the decorator function call. And it sort of cleans up your function-based view, which I like. And the code, there's not a lot of code, so I was like, okay, this is all fine. And then for the Ajax one, it would do something very similar. It would just render JSON response, and it would take that dictionary and pass it back. So I used that library for a long time. I saw those two functions, and then I started thinking of some other things that I tend to do with class-based views, like redirect view from your URLs, or just like a, you know, template view from your URLs, to sort of like some little nice shortcuts, basically.
Yes.
And yes. I was like, well, I can do that in a function-based view as well. It's just I have to write some code to do it. So I took that code and I made it into this library. And it sort of, it tries to encapsulate some of those patterns, but stay in the function-based view world. And so,
the example there is when you're talking about passing init keyword args to the as view function. So you get your template view, as view, and then you pass in some init keyword args. So you don't have to get those per request, right? Is that,
yep.
That's, yeah,
yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I have the same thing. It's just a function inside of my library. So
good,
I look.
That's the other. Hang on, I've got to say, because we talked about multiple settings files earlier. That's the other really old school thing that you're not allowed to admit to doing, but which I do all the time is have you know, a URL conf with like my views kind of just sort of in it, and then okay, I'll have a views.py for, you know, more elaborate stuff.
I mean, if it works, right? Like, it's not the worst thing in the world.
But it seems to be sort of people sort of shaded upon.
Yeah, I mean, it does. It's sort of, you know, you're like mixing two responsibilities, right, in one thing, and so. But
sure, to cut back to go on before we move on, to cut back before to HTMX, Carson Gross has done loads of essays on his site, which I think, regardless of whether you use HTMX or some other library. They're just really good. And one of them is about locality of behavior. And one of the advantages of these kind of HTML over the wire type things is it keeps the behavior in the same place. You're not writing CSS in your JavaScript file, or you're not writing your business logic over here. And it's kind of like I'm writing this template and I just add a few little tags on, and all of a sudden it works. So you spend a lot more time working in the same file, and you don't have to have five files open to read them. And so a lot of these practices that, you know, about mixing behaviors, that you end up with, you know, a forms file that's got one form in it, and then a serializers file that's got one serializer in it, and a filters file that's got one filter in it, and a view file that's got one view in it. And it's like, but hang on, I could just put all of those in one file and they'd fit on one screen, or maybe I have to scroll down a teeny bit and it would all be in one place, and I wouldn't have to have four files open, four tabs where I can't see the stuff. Why can't I just put it in one file? And I've been sort of advocating that to clients for years, and they'd be like, they'd sort of look at me as if it was unprofessional. And I didn't have the jargon to give an argument as to why it wasn't. It was, in fact, the opposite of unprofessional. It was a lesson I'd learned hard over, you know, a decade and more of experience. And then Carson wrote that essay, and I was like, that's the locality of behavior is, anyway, sorry. I just got excited about that.
But it's also a good, I'm remembering, I think I still have it. I had a blog post on an about page, a Django about page, six ways, and basically showing, because I think, like, we all are pretty fluent in Django, right? But like, a lot of people don't know how to import. It's like, wait, if I have a forms file, how do I bring it in? You know, so just being like, okay, like, let's do, you know, an about page six different ways. Like, let's jam it all into one file and, you know, let's break it out is a really great teaching method, I think. No one ever read that post, but I was like really proud of it when I wrote it. And I keep thinking, like, I think there's a lot more here to this. I mean, your talk, Carlton, I mean, part of why I was so excited about your talk was getting at this idea of just, yeah, it has guardrails, but like, you can do whatever you want in Django, but you kind of need to understand the enough of it to feel comfortable doing that, right? Where it's like, yeah, we could do it that way, we could do it this way, versus a beginner is just like, what? Like one file? No, like that breaks all the laws I've just been taught and, you know, memorized but don't understand.
Yeah, no, I mean, yeah. Like, you've got to, if you're beginning, you could go with what it does and just follow along until you're 100% sure. But sometimes it's easier, literally, you know, it's only 100 lines total. Just have the 100 lines next to each other. And, you know,
sorry. Well, it's like learn all the rules and then break all the rules. That's Carlton,
sorry,
right
massively
there.
Massively got sidetracked there by the fact that I was so excited that you were saying you wanted to put your template view in your URL column. I'm like, yes.
Or was there more to add? Was there more to add on that, yeah. Or have you summed up the?
So you were saying before that you wanted to do the same as being able to instantiate a class-based view, or you call the as view within a keyword args, but with function-based view. So. I didn't let you finish because I.
Oh, yeah. I mean, so I started with that, and then I added a couple more just little helper methods. Like, there's one that serves a fav icon. I think I stole that from Adam Johnson's post at some point.
Oh, okay.
Where you can serve like an emoji as your fav icon instead of setting up an actual image. What else do I have? Oh, I have a middleware. So the other thing that people seem to like with class-based views is having a method explicitly for get and for post. So you're kind of splitting up those two pieces. And so the way that I tend to do that now is I have this middleware, and it's really simple. It just looks at the method and then adds a property onto the request object, which is post, is get, is head, is, you know, all the different the verbs. And then, so in my function-based view, I can just do if request dot is get, do my get stuff, or is post and do my post stuff, instead of request dot method equal, you know, get, which looks a little messy and feels not super dry when you see that over and over and over again in your. So it's just little helper things that I added that seem like they're useful.
I think that's a nice example because I find absolutely get the because I'm a more or less class based view man. I write a function based view from time to time, but more or less I use a class based view, and I normally start it class my view inherits from view, and then def get, you know, self request args, keyword args, whatever. And at that point, I look at it as I've got exactly the same as a function based view, which is the request comes in here and I return it from there. But I've got, what I've got is a namespace to break it down at. And of course it's indented and there's a bit of boilerplate and there's a self argument which gets in the way. But the sort of advantage is when you get to if get, if request is get or if request is post, it's sort of outdented because you've got separate handlers for those. And it's what's nice about that sort of circle of examples there is to show that it's entirely equivalent. It doesn't matter which way you do it or which way you like or what you use, because one way is more indented in one type and the other way is more indented in the other. And it's all the same, right? So what are we arguing about? We're arguing about, well, I like blue. No, I like red. Which blue, says someone else. Which red, says someone else. We bike shedding. I mean, but it's, yeah, you know, it's all fun to do. But yeah. I like that example. Anyway, functional based. Did we mention Luke's piece?
Yeah, we didn't, but that was a big
impetus. Let's mention that quickly then.
Yeah, so Django Views the Right Way. It's pretty brilliant. It sort of lays out a case for function-based views. And I actually, borrowed some code from that as well for the redirect view. And it basically, you know, you were talking about Carson's essay about cardinality. It's like when I read Luke's Django View the Right Way, it was like, this is what I've been thinking all along, and I just cannot like put it into words, but like this is so, you know, like my thought process when I was reading it. So highly recommended.
Super.
Yeah, that's an amazing piece. I would say of the top five questions I get from my books, you know, function based versus class based is one of them, and people now cite Luke's piece to me and I'm like, well, I agree, but you know, I'm still going to, okay. I think
I do have one question, which is, if you ignore the inheritance structure of the generic class-based views that provide in Django, which we all agree is very complex and difficult to master. But if you just take the simple class-based views, you know, where you're literally declaring them by hand and then you build and you use the namespace to break your logic up if you need help with methods, which is what I like, versus I find functional composition to be quite a complicated subject for even advanced programmers. And it can be difficult to get your head around and difficult to think in the right ways. And this is just literally a question. Do you think for beginners, which particularly, you know, you target more, will recommending for function-based views and decorator approaches and things, which are, I think, well, are they hard to grok? And is it not easier to teach a class with a namespace, with separate bits? I don't know. That's a question.
Is it to me or to Adam?
I mean, what do you think? I mean, Adam, that's my sort of feeling.
You're thoughts. The guest. What do you think, Adam? Yeah, you're the special guest.
Is it clear the concern? Is it clear what I'm saying? Because I didn't really announce it.
I think for new, if you're brand new to programming and you just want to start, maybe the class-based view makes more sense. I think a lot of my, you know, bias is that I already knew how HTTP worked. And so to me, I'm like, I want a request and I want a response. And I understand that what to do with those things where it's not so abstract. And a lot of my, what I've realized over the years is that I have a reaction because of where I came from with C sharp, where everything is a class. It has to be, everything is OO to the nth degree, and you have interfaces and you have, you know, class hierarchies and things. And so for a long time, I was like, I don't want that. I understand these functions and you can compose them. And it was a visceral reaction to those things. That doesn't mean that they're wrong or they're right. It's just, you know, I think everyone goes through their own learning experience and what makes the most sense to them. And I sort of love, hate that Django has these two ways to render responses, because different people like each of them. And I just think it makes it harder when you're starting. But at the end of the day, like you said, they're equivalent. So, you know, pick your poison as far as I'm concerned.
Yes, no. I think to just come back to me, the gang of four pattern four is a method object where you've got a complicated function and you convert it to a class in order to break the function into separate steps, which are then called from a sort of from the get handler, from the main request handler. So it's a method or a pattern for decomposing your logic. In anyway, that was Will. Do you have thoughts? And then we'll wrap up.
Well, yeah. So the earlier versions of my books, I've mentioned function-based views and shown like a hello world with it, but said, I want to get you up and going and we're going to backfill. And so I haven't gone more into it. I get a lot of emails about it. I have been convinced I want to build at least CRUD with function-based views and do both. But then I want to show like build something out that's like a 20-line function-based view and then be like, this is why generic class-based views exist. And, you know, yeah, you got to do some research, but like changing one line versus having this custom code that repeats a lot. I think, you know, I go, if I can use a generic class-based view, I do. But as you're learning, I think you need to learn both. And so I'm going to add both in more than I currently do. But I still think it's sort of like, if you're teaching a college class, be like, yeah, let's talk about HTTP and let's do it all fundamental principles. But if someone's like, I want to build a website, it's a question of when do you introduce it? For me, like that's the tension I have is like, I don't want to just overwhelm everyone. So I think that I will for the 4.2 versions have function-based views CRUD and show a sprinkling of how messy function-based views can get because, you know, if Luke writes them or, you know, they can be really nice. They can be awful, 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 awful. Whereas, you know, manipulating one or two lines of an existing generic class-based view, I prefer doing.
I've got an old book called Pro Django by Marty Alchin, which when I was getting up, you know, when I was upping my skills, it was really handy. And one, he sort of opens the book with a chapter on Python. He's like, look,
yes,
fundamentally, Django is just Python. And so you need to learn about this, like decorators and properties and descriptors and like all these advanced Python bits. He's like, but if you know these, then you'll understand how Django works. And if you know that Python, then you'll understand that that these different ways, you know, are options.
Well, this is the problem. I find myself, you know, I wrote my books because I didn't like those kind of books, but now that I have more experience, I understand them more, and I find myself rewriting my books to be like those books. So
well,
I have
what
to.
What you need, Will, is a Python book.
Oh my god! Oh my god!
Right.
Yes. All right. Well, Adam, I think we're basically out of time. I know you have a Python utils site, which is built with Unicorn, which is kind of cool. We're going to link to it in the show notes. I don't know if you have a quick snippet you need to say or
something you want to plug or call out you want to do or anything. Anything you'd like to.
You can follow me on GitHub or on Twitter. I don't tweet very much, but occasionally I do. And if you want to keep up to date with, I sort of post updates to what I'm working on and try to be somewhat witty on Twitter. So,
well, I think Django Unicorn, you're looking for some funding, right? I mean, you have these other screencasts and things. If you get more community support, is that still the case?
Yeah, I have GitHub sponsors set up, and I should say I think I have 13 right now, and so I love everyone who has sponsored Unicorn. It's been awesome. I never thought that anyone would sponsor it, so that's been great. And it is sort of, you know, when you're building something like this, it's like you need some intrinsic motivation, obviously, because it's like it's a slog. I've been working on this for 2 years, so like you don't just, it's not overnight or whatever. But the extrinsic motivation is also kind of nice. Of just like, yeah, people love this and they're using it and they want to support open source, and I really appreciate that. So.
Adam, thank you for coming on the show. Really interesting. Thanks for all the work you do in the project. You're just prolific and super, and it's really great to chat to you.
And we are djangochat.com, chatdjango on Twitter, and we'll see everyone next time. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.